You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, can be won. Many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by Firefighters Local 42 and International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Local 1464. The Greater Kansas City Firefighters, IAFF, Local 42 of Kansas City, Missouri, representing fire, EMS, and public safety professionals in Greater Kansas City since 1918. And IBEW Local 1464 reminds all union members to support each other and encourage all workers to buy union and American-made products. We thank our underwriters for their support to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, the exit of manufacturing jobs from Michigan in recent decades turned it into a rust belt. And now, the rust is more than a metaphor. It's in the poisoned water and the dilapidated schools. Even representative government is corroding. Find out about the emergency manager system and the impact on working people on tonight's show. In the news, SEIU launches Justice for Janitors campaign, and what country has the most billionaires now? Our feature at the end of the show is Remember Our Struggle. Now for the news.
This is the news from our site, March 10, 2015. Beijing has overtaken New York as the city with the highest number of billionaires for the first time. A new report by China-based Hurun says a total of 100 billionaires are now living in the Chinese capital, compared with 95 in New York. Hurun tracks wealth in China and puts out an annual global rich list, which uses different methodology than Forbes or Bloomberg. This year, there were 99 new billionaires for a total worldwide of 2,188. China is first in billionaires, the U.S. is second, and India takes third. The world's richest men, and the top 10 are all men, were Bill Gates at $80 billion, Warren Buffett, and Amancio Ortega, the Spanish owner of Zara. Storming up to fourth place was Jeff Bezos of Amazon with wealth of $53 billion. Mexico's richest man, telecom king Carlos Slim, fell from third to fifth place on the list. Facebook's Mark Zuckerberg is sixth with only $46 billion. Larry Ellison of Oracle is seventh, and Charles and David Koch are eighth with a combination of $44 billion. Donald Trump is, of course, on the list, but way down to 203rd, with only $6.5 billion. The richest families remain the Waltons and the Kochs, with a cumulative net worth of $123 billion and U.S. dollars $104 billion, respectively.
SEIU Local 1 held a rally on Tuesday, International Women's Day, to kick off their contract fight and a Justice for Janitors campaign. The target was Blue Cross Blue Shield, which uses a non-union janitorial firm to clean its offices, named Jenny King. One of the speakers was a janitor named Lenora Serrano. She's been a janitor for 6 years. She said, "I'm a mother and a grandmother. Right now, janitors like me live what I call an either-or life. Either we keep the lights on or we put food on the table. Either we take our kids to the hospital or we pay the bills. It's even harder for us working women. Without access to affordable child care or affordable health care or maternity leave, we have to work 10 times harder in order to make ends meet. She said the workers of Blue Cross Blue Shield don't get health care. Several speakers pointed out that irony. SEIU and the workers call on Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas City to hire responsible contractors who are offering working families health care. The union is circulating a sign-on letter to unions and other organizations to support janitor struggles. It says, "We can no longer ignore companies that pay their janitors and their workers substandard wages in order to score higher profits. While these working men and women struggle to feed their families, we cannot stand on the sidelines while companies that champion health care access, like Blue Cross Blue Shield of Kansas City, refuse to hire a responsible contractor that would offer its workers coverage. Kansas City is experiencing an economic resurgence, and we need to guarantee that it benefits everyone, not just wealthy special interests." The rally took place at Union Station, one long block from the Blue Cross Blue Shield offices. But they didn't march because just before the rally, Blue Cross and Blue Shield contacted the union to say they wanted to talk. But it's clear the janitors have to keep the pressure on them, and Janie King and all the other buildings and janitorial contractors, in order to bring up wages and benefits for the invisible people who clean our buildings by night. Blue Cross Blue Shield has said, being a good corporate citizen isn't optional. SEIU plans to hold them to it.
And another SEIU news, this time from St. Louis. St. Charles Community College adjunct faculty voted on Thursday, March 3rd, to unionize with Local 1 and have a voice on the job. The 332 eligible faculty members will join with adjuncts at St. Louis Community College and Washington University to bargain for better jobs. Diana Nash, an English professor, said, "Tonight, the faculty majority at St. Charles Community College has changed from itinerant workers to empowered professionals. We are joining SEIU Local 1 to win the respect that all educators deserve. We look forward to negotiating for job security, higher pay, and benefits." Among the issues raised by these faculty members are the low wages, lack of benefits, and unpredictable scheduling. Lisa Butler, a sociology professor, said, "If a college wants to keep their best educators and add the highest quality new hires, we have to have competitive wages that reflect the quality of an instructor's work and contribution to a college." SEIU Local 1 has been working with college and university professors throughout the Midwest to give them a voice on the job, address the low compensation for their work, and to ensure greater benefits and job security. Adjunct professors at Washington University and St. Louis Community College are currently bargaining their first contract, and others around the Midwest are also working to organize.
And here's a couple of short news clips from around the country. Vermont became the fifth state to require employers to provide a paid sick days for workers. About 60,000 Vermont workers have no paid sick time. The new law requires employers to provide a minimum of 3 paid days a year for employees to use when they or a child or family member is sick. This will eventually cover all employers. The number of days goes to 5 in 2019. Other states requiring paid sick leave are California, Connecticut, Massachusetts, and Oregon. And Labor Notes reports that mechanics at the merged airline United Continental overwhelmingly voted down a tentative agreement that would have established a 2-tier system for wages, sick leave, holiday, and vacations. The Teamsters Union will now ask the National Mediation Board to declare an impasse, which would allow them to strike the airline within 30 days. The news tonight was read by Molly Madden, Shigo Lin, Ham, Jen Zaman, and myself, Matthew Ketcher.
Hello, this is Jacob White. Today is March the 10th, and you are listening to Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 KKFI. For years, the state of Michigan has been a synecdoche for problems that have faced the Great Lakes region and beyond. In this year's Michigan primary, both the left-wing and right-wing grassroots mobilized behind candidates that clearly echoed their own sentiments about why working people in their state and region had seen years of stagnating or declining economic conditions. Both successful candidates were critical of free trade deals and of foreign interventions. Beyond agreeing on those basic principles, however, for the past decade, debate has raged over who is to blame for some of Michigan's largest cities failing to provide adequate basic services. As time has dragged on and evidence accumulates, the answer has become more clear. In a recent opinion piece, Pamela Pugh, treasurer of the State of Michigan Board of Education, wrote, "After more than 6 years of a failed state takeover, Detroit public schools have deteriorated into a destabilized education system marred by decreased academic outcomes and increased deficit, upward of $3.5 billion. Just as Flint's water crisis occurred under emergency management, so did the demise of the Detroit school district." Educators and parents have been raising the red flag for years about dangerous school conditions, only to be snubbed, ignored, and disrespected by DPS and the emergency managers, including Early, said Ivy Bailey, interim president of the Detroit Federation of Teachers, in a statement. "The state has brought the school district to its knees, and now it's time to give up the reins." According to an article by past Heartland Labor Forum guest David Bacon, Michigan cities like Detroit and Flint have been used as a laboratory for market-based policies and the most extreme forms of austerity. The results have been deadly. Bacon states, "As Americans go to the poll to vote this year, they must remember that conservative candidates all over the country are proposing to extend policies like those enacted in Michigan. The actions of politicians shouldn't just be debated in the abstract when people are forced to suffer the very real consequences of political negligence, such as that wrought on Flint and Detroit. Individuals must be held to account." Today, Heartland Labor Forum is glad to have Jean Vortkamp join us from Detroit. Jean has been working for many years to hold individuals to account for their actions in Michigan, and Jean will be talking with Heartland Labor Forum volunteer Christina Hendricks after this brief musical interlude.
We have gathered into barns, done the same work as the men, with babies in our arms. But you won't find our stories in most history books you read. We were there, we're still here, fighting for the things we need. We were there in the factories, we were there in the mills, we were there in the mines and came home to fix the meals. We were there on the picket line, we raised our voices loud. It makes me proud just knowing we were there. From the textile mills in Lawrence to the sweatshops in New York, from the fields in California, where our children had to work, we fought to make a living. Bread and roses was our cry. Though they jailed and beat our bodies, our spirits never died. We were there.
And that was Bev Grant celebrating International Women's Day. Hi, I'm Christina. I am a member of the AFT Local 691. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum on KKFI. Joining me this evening is Jean Vortkamp, president of the Front Porch Organization in Detroit. I got to know Jean during my time at graduate school at Mizzou, and I'm so glad that she can join us to offer her perspective on what is happening in Detroit, Flint, and in Michigan overall. Thank you for joining us, Jean.
Thank you for having me, Christina.
Oh, wonderful that you're on the show. Just to get right into it, could you first describe to us how long have you lived in Detroit?
I've lived in Detroit my whole life.
Really? So on air, we have a lifelong Detroiter and activist. So, so that brings me into my next question. So tell us about, there's a lot of different things that we hear about Detroit every day, especially myself, who before I went to Detroit and worked with your organization and met you, there's a lot of things that I know I took for granted. But tell us about some things that most Americans take for granted that Detroiters do not have access to every day.
Sure. Of course, these are my personal opinions and don't reflect on the views of the Front Porch that I run. So please remember that as I'm speaking. What do we take? Well, I think most Americans take democracy for granted, and we've been deprived of that in several ways, which I can explain later. There are no jobs really in my neighborhood. There are very few. The public transport, I live about 15 minutes from downtown Detroit. I would have to take two buses, and it would take me probably at least 45 minutes to get downtown, and which is a 15-minute drive. Environmental health, you know, Detroit is, you know, our air is not good. The soil is not good. Just basically everything, you know. I mean, they've been working to turn Detroit into, you know, like a lower level of America. Oh, yeah, it's lots of things, Christina.
No, what you've described is as what you have shown us whenever we visit Detroit, what we have seen and everything. But could you also tell us, like, what different jobs you've had when you, as long as you've lived in Detroit?
Let's see, I'm not, I worked in Detroit. Like, actually, the only, I had two jobs that were in Detroit. Most of the time, you have to go outside the city to get a job, which, of course, you can't get to a job because there's no buses. So sometimes I've had to take my bike, and then I get to put the bike on the bus and then take the bus down if I didn't have a car at that time, because the car insurance here is astronomical, just like all insurance in Detroit is astronomical. They want to make sure that you don't have any extra money to spend on anything. I think we have the highest car insurance in the nation, if I'm correct, and our house insurance is insane. Like, I know someone who pays $8,000 a year. Ours is less, but anyway, so I'm sorry, what was your question again?
Oh, I was just asking, like, all the different jobs that you've had in Detroit.
In Detroit, the only jobs I had here was I worked at an art store. I worked in the nightmare that is retail for a long time in an art store, and I also worked at the university.
Yeah, and I remember the first time meeting you, whenever asking you about how to get around Detroit, because we thought about saving money and not bring a car, and you told us that Detroit transportation was unreliable at best. So,
yes, I mean, and you know, looking deeper into it, is that they brought in someone. It was during the Mayor Bing's time. They brought in someone from New York over the transportation department. He cut the service, and when they cut the service, according to federal law, they had to give away 40 buses. So you can imagine, like, Detroit already didn't have enough buses, and then they gave away 40 buses to the suburbs.
Yeah, that's something that I don't feel like we absolutely do take for granted here in other cities. Sometimes there is the transportation is not the best, but something that we do take for granted, and we don't realize what Detroit really does face whenever they do lack.
Yes, I mean, I had, like, I remember one of the pregnant teens, she was trying to get to one of her prenatal appointments, and the bus passed her up because it was full, because they don't put enough buses out, because they don't have enough buses. You know, so, I mean, even that, like, and then people blame, like, well, she's a young mother, how come she's not going to her prenatal appointment? How is she going to get there?
And that sometimes we don't think about. We're like, oh, if she really wanted to, she could just make it on her own. However, I mean, it's much harder than
possible.
We actually think about. Yeah, exactly. Sometimes it's not possible at all. And with all these troubles that Detroit is facing, I know you started the Front Porch organization. Could you tell us about how the Front Porch got started?
The Front Porch is actually on the front porch of my house in Detroit. And just started with, I started doing some studying on the porch during my college years, and there was kids out there, and they started kind of bothering me while I was studying, you know, because they're bored. And then, you know, I started bringing some library books, you know, and then it turned into some origami. And then it just got to be more and more, because also in the neighborhood was a lot of gun violence. I live on the east side of Detroit, where that had been happening for a long time. Actually, I was just kind of used to it. But So they just needed some activities to do. So then it just grew and grew because the kids were kind of demanding more and more things. And then it turned into we had a community center, which was then taken from the community. We had buses that took us on field trips, which were taken from the community later. And, you know, so we did a community center thing, you know, after school with the cooking and the computer lab and homework help and little classes, things that, you know, make, you know, just to keep them busy and happy and get better at school. And then we were helping them at school with their schoolwork, and then their grades were not improving, and we couldn't figure out what was wrong because we'd see them do their homework, they would go to school, and then their grades weren't going up. So we started, we actually asked the advocacy group to help special ed kids, but they wouldn't help us because they said they wouldn't help Detroit. So then we decided to make our own advocacy group, and so we sent out one mom, you know, we hired her, and she went out to different schools and, you know, watched over our kids. She used to go to 11 different schools for, you know, 20 kids and just go check on them, bring them a lunch, and ask their teachers if they needed anything, you know. And then the school and then another school decided to take it, and so we advocate just at that school, and we help kids to improve their grades. We speak with their parents. We get them anything that they're interested in. So kind of, and that we're in the neighborhood as well, so they'll go on field trips with us. So it's basically just trying to rebuild the community that I remembered from when I was a kid before it was all guns and killing everywhere.
Yeah, and you were talking about how much the front porch are growing. Who else starts getting involved in the community or outside the community?
Well, we love that the students from University of Missouri come, and they volunteer with us each year for the alternative spring break. We have lots of people from the suburbs that help out. People in the neighborhood help out. The teenagers that are with us help the younger kids. So it's a really large, diverse group. We have churches that help us. A temple helps us. It's just really people that just genuinely care about children and about their welfare.
So you also, one other question is, I'm also curious about this. So you use the word advocates. So how did you go about choosing the word advocates for the people that that tutor in the front porch?
Because tutoring is not enough. A lot of groups will do tutoring, and we did tutoring, and we realized that that wasn't enough and that we had to link to their parents directly. And I don't mean through a program, and I don't mean through, like, some dumb classes, like they'll give parents classes or, you know, this kind of stuff. No, like, there we have one parent, we text her when we're done working with her son. We'll text her what we did, and she follows up at home because there's a lot of bad press generated about parents in Detroit, and most of it, almost all of it, I would say, 99% of it is a lie, because I've never met a parent that really didn't care about their children, and it's a lot of fathers involved in their lives. So we try to link to either parents or grandparents or older sister, whoever in that family is going to advocate for that child within that family, to help them to, you know, accomplish all the goals that they need in their life.
And you've given us a really great snapshot of both the community and the people of Detroit, how strong they are and how resilient you guys are. And just to get to a little bit more of the meat of the issue, and I think a lot of our listeners are curious about, is everyone, for the most part, knows about how Governor Snyder, his mismanagement of the water crisis in Flint. Could you tell us of any other issues recently or in the past have frustrated activists and community members in Detroit?
That's a long list, Christina, but okay. let's talk about the first one would be the election system here, if I may speak about that. I ran for mayor of Detroit, and I really didn't think I was going to win, but I also didn't think that I was going to find out that the election system here is a joke, because when I went to the recount, I saw that the ballots, it was a write-in campaign for this white man from the suburbs who didn't really live in Detroit, but yeah, he ran for the mayor of Detroit and he won. And so all the signatures were very similar across the city. And while we told everyone at a federal, a state, county, city level, we told all of them about it, nothing happened and nothing changed. So that's the first problem. And you can see those ballots at DetroitRecount.blogspot.com. The second thing would be that they shut off water on thousands and thousands of families in Detroit, thousands of families. And then the families still, they put them on a payment plan instead of giving assistance. And instead, those families, about 26,000 people here, couldn't still pay their water bill even after they were on the payment plan. The bankruptcy was a joke. It was really there to make sure that our water department, what people don't understand about Detroit's water, and a lot of people would say, well, who would want to take over Detroit? Like, why would there be all these things? This the election problems, the bankruptcy, all these things. Like, why would someone even try to go after Detroit's throat like they are, the schools, everything? Detroit has a very, very large water treatment plant and access to the Great Lakes. And as you'll notice, also in Flint, what's getting lost is that there's a pipeline called the Karagandundi Pipeline that was being built to Lake Huron. And to overlook that there isn't a move to privatize the Great Lakes would be a mistake, I think. So the water shutoffs, they shut off the houses in our neighborhood where kids lived. They didn't have water. It was vicious. And also, you know, whenever you shut off the water and you turn it back on, it puts a higher lead content back into your house for a little while, which I didn't understand at the time either. You know, you think your water goes back on, you can just drink it. No, you can't, you know. There was predatory mortgages given here. And so we have a billionaire here named Dan Gilbert, and he's acting like he's saving the city, whenever really he gave out a lot of those predatory loans. We have that hardest hit money from the federal government. It's very hard to get that hardest hit money, and it's also very hard to stop the blight removal, which is code, at least in my opinion, for, you know, moving regular Detroiters out of Detroit. And so they took at least $100 million, if not more, from the hardest hit fund, which most people can't access to save their homes because of the predatory mortgages, and they use it for blight removal, which is mashing down the houses, which they're, you know, overcharging how much it costs to mash down the houses. So also, we were under emergency management, which I don't think is sad, but I don't think that that's really getting out, is what a threat that is to democracy, to the United States of America. The emergency management is when they put in someone over our mayor and city council. And they also did that in Flint, so I think more people are becoming aware of it. They did it in Benton Harbor, at Muskegon Heights schools. They do it, and they did over Detroit Public Schools, and they do it to supersede democracy. You know, I mean, I think if there's a problem with elected officials, they should be investigated and removed. But you don't just put someone, you cannot just appoint people, like these kinds of things, where you appoint people or put a board in charge. Like Detroit still has a financial review board over it. In other words, the mayor and the city council are not in control of their money, and the people on it, like there's a developer on it, there's a person who owns a giant transportation company. Like, what is that? That is not democracy. You know, these things, emergency management comes from Romney's people used it, Massachusetts under him. It was used in the Second Reich, which helped to make the things that Hitler did under the Third Reich legal. I mean, this is not a joke, what's going on here. We live under a system, or we did live, they got rid of the emergency manager, but the funny thing is the emergency manager, the governor, and the current mayor, who had those ballots, all went to school together at University of Michigan, in the same, like, almost at the same time period. So you will find a lot of things here all lead back to this a small group of people over and over and over again. So, and then there's also a plan called the Detroit Future City, which if you know in St. Louis, you might know Baron Salazar McCormick. Well, Richard Baron started this plan called Detroit Works here because he said he used to live here and he wanted to help us, which I don't really understand how a developer wants to help people, but okay, we'll go with that. And Richard Baron started this Detroit Works project, and it was where they told some people they had to move out of certain parts of the city because they were going to make Detroit smaller. And while people started booing and openly abusing the mayor, for that plan. And so they put it back in the closet. They came back out with it as a Detroit Future City plan. And in that, they're mashing down pieces of the city and putting, like, ponds and things for water drainage and things, like, all over the city, where right now there's houses.
Yeah, and
so,
yeah, a lot of the points you're bringing up, I think people are definitely starting to be more aware of what's happening, what's going on, and connections to the two other cities just besides Detroit. And right now we're going to be going on to our break, and when make sure our listeners stay tuned, because in the second half we will be tackling the issues in Detroit public schools. Stay tuned.
Despite recent economic hardships in Greece, the Greek island of Kos has welcomed thousands of refugees that have appeared on its shores without food, water, or legal status. Check out this compelling story of humanity and love on Wings, Saturday afternoon at 2:30.
Paris of the Plains podcast is dedicated to telling unheard audio stories from the people of Kansas City. Join us this Thursday night at 7 p.m. on KKFI to hear some of KC's most powerful stories. I'm Matt Hodapp. Thanks for listening.
Welcome back. You're listening to Heartland Labor Forum on 90.1 KKFI. I'm Christina Hendricks here with Gene Voorkamp, who is the president of Front Porch Organization in Detroit. In the last segment, we talked about a little about her history with Detroit and the current situation that Michigan is facing. In this segment, we will be talking about the emergency manager and the sick-ins in Detroit public schools. So, Gene, since this is all pretty topic, I'll just jump right into it. Could you tell a little bit about what condition DPS schools or Detroit public schools are in right now physically?
Yeah, they have a lot of problems. There's a lot of issues with how the schools have been maintained. And the question is really, where was the money to put that in? Because I know that lots of people at those schools have done what they were supposed to do to put in, you know, to ask for those things, for everything to be fixed, you know, for, you know, falling tiles off of a ceiling or all kinds of things. Everything that you can imagine being wrong with a school there, you know, is so, yeah, I mean, they're just not in good shape. And the question is, where's that money that's supposed to fix them? And if emergency management is all that, well, then how come they're not fixing the schools with that? I mean, because truly, I mean, emergency management is really just a way to siphon money away from children. And I don't agree with adults taking opportunities from children, taking money from children, making them be in an unsafe environment.
Yeah, recently I think there's been more word spread about, because I know through social media there have been pictures of Detroit public schools. Even Al Jazeera has run a few things on the pictures of what state the public school system is in physically. What about the size of the classrooms? What are the average size that you've seen, that how many students are within a classroom?
I know some of the kids have told me that there's about, like in some high schools, there's 50 kids in a class, more than that. It's really unhealthy. The one thing I want to say about the schools and the condition that they're in is that that there is many people here that would use that as an opportunity to get contracts for their friends to fix those schools. So they are in bad shape. I am reluctant to dwell on that subject because that is not, I can see, because you have to understand how corrupt Detroit is that what it is that there's just a group of wealthy people that just siphon the money out of Detroit, and they just look at it as like they can just vacuum money out of like water department contracts, school contracts, every which way that they can, and then get a kickback. And so that's why I'm a little, I don't know, whenever everybody talks about the condition of the schools, I'm not, you know, so concerned about that as I am about other things, such as what you're talking about the class sizes.
Yeah.
Which are crazy. And the thing is that teachers are dropping like flies out of the school system because they aren't making hardly any money. Like, their health insurance is astronomical. Their pay has been cut. The school system, like, took $10,000, but I don't really understand how this happened. Some kind of tip money. I'm still not clear on that. But the school system took some loan from them. I don't know what kind of government takes a loan from workers, but okay.
And could you explain to us a little bit, you already started doing it, but a little bit about the sick-ins that the teachers have been advocating for recently?
Right. I think it's because they can't strike because they all have so little money to start with. I mean, they're all living on the edge of poverty as it is, that the strike would be no pay. So I think that's why they're doing the sick-ins.
And I... And specifically, what else has the community been doing to support the teachers within the schools in terms of the sick-ins?
No, I don't know. I haven't really seen anything. I'm sorry.
Oh, no. That's perfectly fine. My next question is, when you were talking about teachers and how teachers were just dropping like flies and leaving left and right, what has Detroit Public Schools done in terms of hiring new teachers? I know Teach for America has been stepping in. Do you think Teach for America has been more beneficial or detrimental to Detroit Public Schools?
Well, I can just speak to what I haven't actually interacted with that situation, but I can speak to what I've heard from the kids tell me about the Teach for America teachers, is that they find them very fun because they are usually not from Detroit and they're usually from the suburbs and not used to dealing with urban children. And so urban children have maybe a different sense of humor about things and a different perspective on things than a suburban teacher or a suburban Teach for America person. I'm not a teacher, sorry. And so they have a lot of fun with them.
You do bring up a really good point. A lot of people I've heard brought up the point before is that there's all these vacancies, and so the best thing to do would be bring in people from TFA, from Teach for America, these teachers who are willing to work in Detroit Public Schools. And do you know anything else that they will be doing to hire new teachers? Do you know anything else that they would be trying to do to reach out to bring more teachers into Detroit Public Schools?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I don't understand why they don't just pay the teachers that they have what they're worth, give them some respect their union, and, you know, give them a reasonable class size. These are simple things that all over the United States go on, just like other cities have a superintendent, they have an elected school board. But for some reason, Detroit is not allowed to have these things. And I find that suspicious and almost, and honestly, malicious. I mean, all these things together that are being done to Detroit are really rooted in racist greed, and they need to stop.
And you just talk about it's really rooted in racism and everything. What else in terms of either Detroit Public Schools or Detroit itself have you seen any sort of segregation or any boundaries drawn?
Wow, I mean, Detroit is crazy like that. It is, just near my neighborhood is Grosse Pointe, and if you just cross the boundary between Detroit and Grosse Pointe, the street that's there, you will see all the houses are better. You will see mostly white people, and then you cross the street back, and all the houses are, you know, not because people don't want to take care of them, it's because people don't have money to take care of them, and landlords are not forced to take care of homes in Detroit, and banks have played a giant role in destroying Detroit's housing stock, because when they own the house, they don't take care of them anymore. They don't pay the taxes on them. But they hardly ever get blamed, but people that live here get blamed for everything. So Detroit is bizarrely, I mean, like the South, and I don't think a lot of people recognize that, like what you would think the South was, you know, like the downtown now is almost all white people that think that they own downtown now, the gentrifiers, you know, they think, haha, we took Detroit back downtown, and then around that is a whole bunch of us that, and just all the people that don't have a lot of money, mostly African-American and some parts Latino. And then out in the suburbs, they're pushing, like, our Section 8. There's hardly any Section 8 houses, like, in our neighborhood left. But Section 8 is open in Warren and Inkster, like, these surrounding suburbs, because they're trying to make Detroit like all the other cities on Earth, where the richy cities, like, where downtown is all rich and fancy and gentrified and without any culture and sterile and disgusting, with all just you know, giant businesses owning everything. And then all the poor people work out, way out, and they just cook all the food for the rich people, and they take, like, a two-hour bus ride in, you know. It's frightening, it's disgusting, and I wish that we were not going backwards in time for civil rights, like, at 100 miles an hour here. Because it wasn't like this, I wouldn't even say, like, 15 years ago. It's just, it's clearly been a plan that they've made, and they're moving forward with it, and the left is not fighting back in the way that they need to.
Yeah, and just bringing back, because you're definitely talking about some of the lines that have been drawn in Detroit. And one thing I know you've mentioned before whenever I've talked with you, and bringing back to Detroit Public Schools, is the EAA, the Education Achievement Authority. Is that could you explain that a little bit to our listeners and what that is?
It's like an extra public school system, like where they took some, like, about 15 schools from Detroit Public Schools and made it the lowest achieving schools or something. Made it into its own school district, and it's not achieving. And the kids spend just a lot of time on computers. It's weird. It's creepy. It's just another hack at the public school system. You know, that the right wing doesn't want a public school system. And this is one of their ways, just like with charter schools, it's another way to get it. And another way is that, like, our emergency manager now, I don't know if you saw this, is now the judge that did the bankruptcy, which is Judge Rhodes. And who puts a bankruptcy judge over a school district? Because he's a bankruptcy judge that made sure that the Detroit workers lost their pensions, and he's going for the teachers' pensions. And this piece of what's happened to Detroit should be alarming people all over the country, because they overrode our Constitution to take pensions. And that is not what bankruptcy was for. That was not what municipal bankruptcy was for, but that's what they did. And here's this judge now in the public school system trying to take it over. And really, I mean, really, like, he's not going to take the pensions. That's not his goal. You know, it's frightening. And it's frightening that this is just allowed to just go on. You know, and when the bankruptcy was happening in Detroit, a lot of people from around the country should have been here to help us. But, you know, the unions capitulated, everything capitulated, and now they're just running roughshod.
Yeah, as we can see, definitely Detroit can be seen as a warning, an unfortunate warning, that plenty of cities and people within the United States have ignored, unfortunately, or turned their backs. And whenever you were also mentioning, well, mentioned earlier, could you explain how the whole situation with the emergency manager during our early came about? Could you explain how, just briefly, how that whole situation with putting emergency manager in Detroit happened?
Like, how did they get an emergency manager?
Yes.
I don't actually. I think the first one was Bob. I'm not sure. I think it was a Democratic governor. Jennifer Granholm, who is now on the board of a bank. She appointed the first one, and, you know, I'm not sure what kind of reasoning they had for that. I wasn't, you know, I don't know any more than that, but, yeah.
Yeah, so you can definitely see how it's affecting the school system. And in what other ways are you seeing what's happening with the schools, with the sick-ins that the teachers are expressing and with the money that's being siphoned out, what other ways do you see it impacting the direct community around the schools?
Well, even how it affects the children is that what they're doing is, it almost seems like, they just keep, it's like an assault what's going on in Detroit. It's like, just whenever you think nothing more bad will happen, okay, the water shut off, okay. Well, now, okay, so this week they're saying that the schools are going to run out of money April 8th. It's like they have to keep a constant state of alarm going on in the city and in the state for anyone in a minority, in a city where there's a minority population there. Like, they have to just keep it going. Like, there's always going to be an emergency. And it's unhealthy because the kids react to that. Like, the kids, like, and nothing is stable. When all the teachers are upset, that doesn't make for a good school day for all the kids. It is, it's actually quite cruel. I mean, on a day-to-day level, I mean, for the pensioners, they're always saying, now they're saying they want to go back and take the pension money again because they made a mistake when there wasn't a reason to take the pensions from Detroit pensions anyway. They were funded better than many pensions in the United States. And there's a city called Central Falls, Rhode Island, and they had fired, I read that they fired all their teachers in Central Falls, Rhode Island. Central Falls, Rhode Island is also where they first cut the pensions. They took all the firefighters in a gym and told them they were taking 50% of their pension. So you see, there's a movement here at the Manhattan Institute in New York, the Mackinac Policy Center in Michigan. It's ALEC, right? I mean, it's ALEC's plan, to move forward with this, to destroy the public sector, to take pensions in the public and the private area. People should be alarmed. People should be fighting this in every which way that they can. You can't sit home anymore. You can't just sit there and think like, oh, the system will take care of it. My elected official will take care of it. No, at least not in Detroit. We've learned that lesson. We know we don't really have any elected officials. We know that nobody in the federal government is responding to anything. We asked them to take away the emergency managers a long time ago. We asked Eric Holder. Eric Holder now works at Covington, which is a white-collar defense law firm. So, who can help us? We find that in Detroit a lot. Like, there is nobody to help us. All we have is ourselves.
And definitely I can see a lot of people in the community, including yourself and with the organization, definitely pursuing goals to fight back and to make Detroit grow once again. So one of my final questions is going to be, what successes do you want to see in Detroit in the next few years?
I would like to see an overhaul of the election system with a hand-counted ballot, which is the best way to count ballots, so that in the future, children that want to grow up to be in public service because they want to help their community in a role that's an elected official, that's an opportunity for them. I used to pass by the little, I passed by little signs for kids running for their little community, their little council at school, and it made me almost cry because I realized that perhaps my whole life there, my vote hasn't counted, that no one who ran really had a chance here, that it's just controlled by a small group of people. I would like to see all the federal funding wrangled back so that it goes back into Detroit communities instead of downtown for gentrifying. I would like to see capital go into small businesses, small African-American businesses in Detroit. I would like to see restaurants in my neighborhood where people that live here and right now are cooking behind the curtain for white people have their own restaurants, their own capital, that they're making their own money off of their own labor. I mean, these are very basic dreams, and I'm so sad that this is the point that we're at in this country, and in particular in Detroit.
Yeah, and absolutely, everything you said is a goal, I think, that I know I want to see Detroit make within the next few years. And there's such a long list that sometimes I don't think we really realize of how much ground that Detroit needs to cover to gain back what they lost. So my very last question is going to be, for our listeners who are just curious and want to find out more information about what work you do in Detroit, where can people go online to find more information about the Front Porch and what work you do in Detroit?
Okay, about the Front Porch, you can go to frontporchdetroit.org, and that tells you about the work that we do. if you want to know about Detroit in general, I have my old blog up from when I was mayor. It just has a lot of research about Detroit. It's Mayor Gene, which is funny. I know, mayorgene.blogspot.com. And if you want to read about Detroit news, the best news source, because, of course, we don't have a functional media here either. They just, they're just a mouthpiece for what's going down here. So voiceofdetroit.net is a good news source for Detroit.
All right. Excellent. And thank you very much. And thank you once again, Gene, for coming on the Heartland Labor Forum. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Which side are you on? Which side are you on?
Good evening and welcome to Remember Our Struggle. I'm Ariana Eckel. On March 8, 1975, the United Nations established a holiday to honor women, their contributions, and their struggle. They called it International Women's Day. They didn't invent the holiday, though. It had already been honored for decades through marches, work stoppages, and even a revolution. In November of last year, I featured the 1908 Uprising of the 20,000 in New York and Clara Limlich, one of the leaders. This rebellion of young immigrant women inspired many, including another Clara across the ocean, to call for the establishment of a date to celebrate and encourage women's struggle. At the International Working Women's Conference in Copenhagen in 1910, Clara Zetkin proposed that every year in every country there should be a celebration on the same day, a Women's Day, to press for their demands. The conference of more than 100 women from 17 countries representing unions, socialist parties, and working women's clubs, and including the first three women to be elected to the Finnish parliament, met Zetkin's suggestion with unanimous approval, and thus International Working Women's Day was born. International Working Women's Day was honored for the first time in Austria, Denmark, Germany, and Switzerland on the 19th of March. More than a million women and men attended IWD rallies fighting for women's rights to work, to vote, to be trained, to hold public office, and to end discrimination. Less than a week later, on 25th of March, the Triangle Shirtwaist Fire in New York City took the lives of more than 140 working women, most of them Italian and Jewish immigrants. Clara Limlich even lost her cousin in the disaster. The event drew significant attention to the terrible working conditions and labor laws of the United States, and these issues became a focus of subsequent International Working Women's Day's events. The Russian Revolution in 1917 actually began with a massive strike by women textile workers in Petrograd, now St. Petersburg, on International Working Women's Day against the orders of the unions and left-wing political parties of the country. The strikes sparked full revolution in a country already dangerously tense. The strikes doubled in size to 200,000 workers, and over the next few days, 66,000 men of the local army garrison joined forces with the strikers. Soon, the Tsar was forced to abdicate. So don't forget, it's called International Working Women's Day, and it's not something that the UN gave to us. It's something that women and members of the working class dreamed of and fought to create. Mark your calendars, fellow workers. It's March the 8th. 10,000 times has the labor movement stumbled and fallen and bruised itself and risen again, been seized by the throat and choked and clubbed into insensibility, enjoined by courts, assaulted by thugs, charged by the militia, shot down by regulars, traduced by the press, frowned upon by public opinion, deceived by politicians, threatened by priests, repudiated by renegades, preyed upon by grafters, infested by spies, deserted by cowards, betrayed by traitors, bled by leeches, and sold out by leaders. But notwithstanding all this and all these, it is today the most vital and potential power this planet has ever known, and its historic mission of emancipating the workers of the world from the thraldom of the ages is as certain of ultimate realization as is the setting of the sun. Those are the powerful words of Eugene Debs, American labor leader and political leader. On this day in 1919, he was sentenced to 10 years of prison and stripped of his citizenship for giving a speech. Eugene Debs was first elected to the Indiana General Assembly on a Democratic ticket and was instrumental in founding several unions. He led the famous Pullman strike of 1894, which was so successful that the United States Army had to break it. Debs got 6 months in jail for his part. While in jail, Debs read several works of socialist theory and emerged 6 months later as an ardent socialist. Debs was noted for his oratory skills, and his speech denouncing American participation in World War I led to his second arrest in 1918. He was convicted under the Sedition Act of 1918 and sentenced to a term of 10 years, and part of the sentence also included stripping him of his citizenship. However, while in prison, Debs ran for president of the United States, and despite his incarceration, garnered 3.4% of the vote. President Warren G. Harding commuted his sentence in December 1921, and Debs got to remain an American citizen. Eugene Debs died in 1926, not long after being admitted to a sanatorium due to cardiovascular problems that developed during his time in prison. He has since been cited as the inspiration for numerous politicians, including current presidential contender Bernard Sanders, who has a photo of Debs hanging in his office. This has been Remember Our Struggle. Thank you and have a good evening.
Thank you, Arianna Eckel. And now for our calendar. There's not much going on this week, but next Thursday, March 17th, there's going to be a rally for justice against the Missouri legislature's attempts to limit voting rights with IDs requirements, discriminate against same-sex couples, and its ongoing failure to expand Medicaid. That's from 9:45 a.m. to 2 p.m. in the state capitol in Jefferson City. And if you want more information about this lobby day, go to the Empower Missouri Facebook page. Next Thursday, also at 7:30 a.m., is the Faith Labor Alliance, that's March 24th. The Faith Labor Alliance, organized by Jobs with Justice, it's at the Sheet Metal Workers Hall at 2902 Blue Ridge Boulevard. On March 24th, also 2 weeks from tonight, Stand Up KC is having a film showing of a film called Standing on My Sister's Shoulders, The Civil Rights Struggles of Women for the Vote, with a focus on Fannie Lou Hamer. That's going to be at the Tivoli Theater. And in order to be able to go, you need to RSVP for tickets to info@standupkc.org. Another lobby day in Jeff City is going to be on March 30th. That's a Labor Day and rally in Jeff City against right to work and repeal the attempt to repeal the prevailing wage laws. That's from they're going to be lobbying from 10 to 11:30 a.m. and a rally at noon, once again at the state capitol. It's sponsored by the Missouri State Building and Construction Trades Council. On Saturday, April 2nd, there's a construction career fair. That's from 8:30 to 11:30 a.m., and it's going to be at the Mohart Center, 3200 Wayne Avenue in Kansas City. All the trades will be there. You must be 18 years of older to be able to enroll in an apprenticeship program. And then on April 2nd, Flint, Michigan Water Drive. This is sponsored by the Coalition of Black Trade Unionists. It's going to be at UAW Local 249. 8040 Northeast 69 Highway in Claycoma between 9 a.m. and 3 p.m. I guess you should bring some water. That's it for the calendar. If you want to see our entire calendar, go to our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. One last thing. AT&T is hiring installation technicians and retail sales consultants. Go to att.jobs/get-hired. There's also a hiring event tomorrow, Friday, from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. at the KC Airport Hilton, but you have to register first at that webpage. Again, you can find our calendar on our webpage at heartlandlaborforum.org. That's it for tonight's show. Tune in next week. Our show is called A Streetcar Named Non-Union and Missouri Legislature to KC. Bend Uber. Thanks to our engineer, Jen Zaman.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.